It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Cyclists are making final preparations for the Fireweed 400, the race across Alaska that begins Saturday morning. 750 riders will gather at 6 a.m. to start at the Sheep Mountain Lodge on the Glen Highway to race to Valdez 200 miles away across some of Alaska's most beautiful country. Many will stop there, but the most competitive riders will turn around and ride back up the mountains 200 miles to the starting point. If you look at video of the race that we have up at alaskapublic.org, you can see that these people are not all super aggressive cyclists. Many are out just for fun. On today's Outdoor Explorer, we'll find out why. And since we're live in the studio today, I invite you to join us with your own reasons if you've done the Fireweed, and your questions if you haven't. And you can do that on Facebook at Outdoor Explorer. So we have three guests. And because the race is actually getting set up right now, we have a slightly different guest lineup than we expected. Peter Leekish, the race director, was going to be with us, and it turns out that he's dealing with a crisis of moving a checkpoint and dealing with other issues out in Glen Allen. So George Stransky, another race organizer, has kindly offered to jump in Peter's place. Thanks for being with us, George.
Thanks for having me.
And in the studio, Janice Tower, who is a competitive cyclist and is involved in single track trails here in Anchorage. She was on the show not that long ago talking about that topic. And you're getting ready to get out for the Fireweed and really ride fast Saturday,
hey? Yep, that's the intention anyway.
That's the plan, yeah. And Pam Kravitz is in the studio too. A lot of people will recognize Pam's voice. And she is a recreational rider who's done the race a number of times, but not to try to win, right, Pam?
I think that's a really good way of putting it. Yeah.
We're calling you a recreational rider.
I love it, yeah.
So, George, you've got 750 people getting ready to come out there and ride that highway. This must be a huge just organizational thing just to pull this whole thing together.
Yeah, we'd like to thank the state troopers and the Department of Transportation. They do a great job helping us put the race on over a highway that's kept open during the race.
And there's a bunch of construction going on, and there'll be pilot cars and all kinds of stuff happening.
Yeah, usually there's a few hundred yards of pavement disruption, but this time there'll be a 4-mile section about 5 miles before you get to Glen Allen that will be torn up. And if you go through it during the day from 7:30 to 5:30, there might be pilot cars that you have to wait for before going through.
Mm-hmm. So, Janice, does that worry you when you're trying to set a time and maybe even set a record if you have that kind of barrier in your way?
Well, the race directors fortunately decided to push the start back for the people doing the 400-mile distance. So if we're lucky, we'll get toward Glen Allen and that section of road will be open without pilot cars. But if not, we're not too concerned because a rider can hop in the support vehicle and sag forward. Now, if there is delays with the pilot car, I mean, that's just one of those things that you have to deal with. And, you know, it's really not too big a deal. You just kind of roll with it.
Mm-hmm. Explain what you're talking about the support vehicle.
The 400-mile riders, whether you're on a team or solo, you have to have at least one support vehicle. And you have a two-person crew in there, and they are taking care of you and driving, and they take all of your gear should you need extra wheels or extra clothing. So you've got other people who are supporting you on the way.
Mm-hmm. So are you doing a solo 400, or are you doing teamwork, or how are you going to do the race?
This year I'm on a 4-woman team, which will be different for me because I'm usually a soloist, so I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone there. But we're all really good friends, and we just decided, hey, let's just do this for fun and go out and have a good time and, you know, break out of our comfort zone a little bit. So we're just first and foremost want to have a really positive, fun experience. And if we happen to go fast, then that's great.
Well, now, I may be jinxing you, but somebody told me you're hoping to set a record.
Well, I believe this is the first year there have been all women's four-person teams. So, yeah, we would like to come out ahead, obviously. But, you know, like I say, we're just in it to have a good time. Uh-huh.
So, George, there's all kinds of different categories of riders in the Fireweed 400. There's relays and there's different. What are all the different choices people have as how they're going to do the race?
They can do an out and back 50, an out and back 100, out and back 400, or a 200 one way from Sheep Mountain Lodge to Valdez. We really encourage the entire family to participate, and we have over 20 cases where adults are in the event along with their children.
Oh, cool! That sounds great. And so that must So like the out and back 50, they ride out the highway, turn around, and ride back to the Sheep Mountain Lodge, opposed to going to Valdez. I see. Wow, that must make for a very complex organizational thing. How many volunteers do you have working on this thing?
There are about 120 volunteers that come out every year to help us out. It's a terrific effort on the part of the aid station people and the race organizers. There's nobody that gets paid for any of this at all.
That's amazing.
And basically, we're just trying to help promote youth athletics in Alaska. And it takes about half of our budget to put the race on, and it takes about half of the budget that is available to give to youth support organizations.
Huh. So, and 750 riders, is that a record? Is that the most you've had?
If we have 750 start, it'll be a record. It's the most we've ever had, and it's a pretty good, there are more than 50 people from the lower 48. There's 6 people from Europe, several people from Italy, and they're all afraid of our local Alaskan cyclists. I mean, they
should be, right?
They are worried about people like Janice Tower. And this non-competitive Pam Kravitz that does the 400-miler on a relay team 4 or 5 years in a row.
Yeah. We're talking about the Fireweed 400 bike race on Outdoor Explorer. It's coming up on Saturday, going from sort of the middle of nowhere on the Glen Highway to Valdez and back for those who do the whole 400 miles. And that was George Stransky, who's one of the race organizers. Janice Tower, you heard from just a moment. And Pam Kravitz has also done this race a bunch of times. What is the attraction, Pam? Why do something that is so hard? Why not do something easier?
Why do something easier? Oh, and I see Janice nodding. Because these long-distance events are really fun. They're fun to train for. They're fun to see other people you know in. I've been doing long distance for a really long time, and I think I've met really wonderful people doing it in the training and in the doing of it, too. So a lot of it is social. I mean, I understand completely, you know, that dynamic between being with people and still wanting to be competitive. That's something we're not going to have to worry about too much on our team this year.
And not being too competitive?
No, we're not going to be too competitive.
So how long does it take you to do this?
Which year?
Well, what do you expect? Are you doing the whole 400 this year, or 200, or 100?
I think we've done the 400 for a number of years. We actually did the 400 the first year. And one of the people who did it with us the first year is doing it with us again, Yvonne Goldsmith. Mm-hmm. And my son did it too. And I just remember the people who we were leapfrogging with kept saying, oh, we don't want to see that boy with the white shirt on again. Because he was faster than the rest of us.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So in total, was it take 2 days? Or how do you do it exactly?
I think the fastest we've done the 400 is 24 hours plus. And now we're getting much slower. Mm-hmm. So... I don't know. I mean, I really don't know. And I don't even know how long we did it last year. I mean, this is your recreational athlete. I try not to, you know,
if you
have
don't
a
know
number. Right, exactly.
You don't have a goal. Your goal is to finish.
I want to be home Saturday night.
All right.
I mean, home with the dogs. Yes, that's my goal there.
Saturday night. It starts, you mean Sunday night?
No, Saturday night. We'll finish all in a day. Oh, yeah.
The 400-mile race starts a day earlier than all the other categories.
I got you.
So our race actually starts, I believe, tomorrow at 3:45 from Sheep Mountain Lodge. And the organization decided to do it that way so that when the 400-mile people were finishing back at Sheep Mountain Lodge, all the other groups would be going out on their races, so there'd be, you know, people to cheer them on and a lot more camaraderie that way.
Oh, cool.
In years past, you get back to Sheep Mountain, it's like everybody's gone home. It's like, okay, shut out the lights. But
I know how that feels. I've been to a lot of ski races where I get there and like all the food is gone, everybody's driving away. But that's just because I'm so slow.
Yeah, and I tell you, for those people coming back up that hill from Glen Allen back to Sheep Mountain, it's a huge boost to have people heading out toward Valdez the other direction, cheering you on, and you know, you just really puts a smile back on your face, and yeah, it's really, really wonderful community support.
I didn't realize that. So different people starting at different times. I assumed everybody started at the same time. So how long, Janice, would you expect to take for 400 miles?
For our team, you know, we're hoping to come in under 24 hours.
And that's 24 continuous hours.
Yeah. Just constant changing out riders, trying to minimize any kind of time when you don't have a rider out on the road. So your transitions had to be very well organized and pretty precise to make that happen.
So I think people would be really interested in understanding how this works. The support vehicle is driving along with the four riders. Are there more than one support vehicle for the four riders?
There can be more than one. I think ideally you would have two cars supporting the team. Now, there's any number of scenarios that you can dream of to coordinate all four riders, whether you have two riders in one car or two riders per car and they're leapfrogging each other, or all four riders in one car and you have one car, the other car kind of hanging back and supporting the rider that's out on the road. And that's all part of the fun of strategizing and coming up with a plan, you know, and you're kind of wondering what the other teams are doing and how long they're going to be out there taking their individual pulls. So
is it a standardized amount of distance you have to, Pam, that you have to like do the same number of miles each time, or you just ride till you're tired and then hand it on to somebody else?
I think it's just like Janice says, every team sort of figures it out for themselves, how they want to coordinate their, the way they trade off. The way we've been trading off, actually since I've been doing it, is every 20 minutes. And it doesn't make any difference how far you go, but it's a time length, because you can keep going about as fast as you can go for 20 minutes, and then you can take a break, and the next person, it kind of keeps your speed up. So the longer you go for somebody, it depends on what kind of shape you're in, but you tend to slow down.
So that gives you only 60 minutes of rest until it's your turn again, right?
Well, actually, the way we do it, and since we're completely non-competitive,
I'm listening.
I think I'm really happy that it's all women on your team, because we are a mixed team. And so there's no chance of us even having to worry about where you are. And we will be cheering you as you are going up the hill out of Valdez as we're coming down the hill, if we even see you there. But the way we do it is, it's two couples doing it in our four person. So one couple will do basically 2 hours of switching off. So each three, you know, switch off three times, and then the second couple will. So that way everybody gets a 2 hour break, which in the past, because I've done it as a two person, 400, and that's brutal. That's brutal if you're switching off every 20 minutes.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I don't even know how you do it. I think you just fall apart. Of course, some people are doing the whole thing by themselves, so we don't even have to talk about the immortals, the people. Have you done the whole thing, Janice? 400 miles?
Yeah, I've done it. You've
done some other 24-hour races. You've done a tremendous amount of the super endurance stuff. I mean, it's hard for me when I finish like the Tour of Anchorage, 3 hours and whatever. I'm crushed. I'm not done for a day. To think that I would go on for another, 21 hours is inconceivable. And I just wonder how you do that.
Well, first of all, you're not going as fast as you would for a 3 hour race.
Uh-huh.
You're definitely riding within yourself, fairly even pressure on the pedals, and just, trying to maintain something that you can sustain for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, people get into trouble when they take off too hard, because, 5 or 6 hours later, they're kind of done.
Yeah.
So you really have to be disciplined to maintain a constant rate of progression so that you don't totally crater when you get to Valdez and have to climb back up that pass again.
That's insane. Yeah. Outdoor Explorer, we're talking about the Fireweed 400 bike race. That was Janice Tower, who is the who's a real athlete. She's really won some races and done some amazing stuff, not only in Alaska, but around the country on her bike. And Pam Kravitz, who's a real great person in many ways. It sounds like she's not trying to win bike races, but she is, has done it many times and finished, and that's fantastic. And then on the phone is George Stransky, who's one of the organizers. George, I was wondering about the safety factor here. It is a highway with vehicles going by at a high rate of speed, and some of them are big, wide RVs being driven by people who maybe are not the greatest drivers in the world. Do you have any rules or any ways of keeping bikes and vehicles separated so it's safe?
Oh, we do a number of things for safety. First, we pick the course for a low traffic volume. We do it the weekend after July 4th, so we get the good weather, but we have the lower traffic volumes. There are four state troopers that'll patrol the course and give speeding tickets and anybody that pulls off the road unsafely and forces riders out into traffic will be ticketed. We also have put safety first all the time with the race, and we keep emphasizing that. So we, especially for the people that are in the race themselves and you're supporting your rider, we want to make sure you pull off the far enough so that when you open your door, you force none of the other competitors out into traffic.
Mm-hmm. Now, I heard someone say that there's no drafting, that the cyclists are supposed to sort of keep farther apart than that. True?
We have time trial events where you're not supposed to draft, and we have open events where you may draft.
I see. So different rules for the different races.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the 400, the soloists are not supposed to draft. You know, and in the relays, usually there's one person out at a time, but it's certainly possible, like near the end, you might want to put the entire team out to bike together. There's no rule against that.
Oh, I see. So it sounds like you've broken things up a bit. So is that in terms of when people start, is that to avoid just having this huge mass of cyclists hitting the road at the same time and potentially being a traffic hazard?
That's true. Yeah, we do wave starts. We do allow the slower riders to leave earlier than the regular start, but we don't let the fast riders leave earlier. That way they can make the cutoff times for the longer distances. We also did have a mass 200 start when we first were running the race, but we only had 124 people in the first race. But then there was a big wad of cyclists that were on the road over a short distance of a mile to 5 miles. And so this really helped a lot with having people leaving in wave starts so that there were never more than two abreast at any one time.
Yeah. Pam, do you ever feel kind of scared out there? It seems, I mean, I can think of a couple of things that would be scary. I always feel a little intimidated when I'm on a highway riding my bike. And then lots of bikers around might make it a little bit more intimidating. And the other thing, I don't know if I'm just a chicken, but the idea of riding down Thompson Pass, I think I'd be riding the brakes the whole way. I mean, that is so steep for such a long time. Do you feel a little bit of courage required to do this?
I'm not real crazy about the motorhomes, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if anything that scares me, it's a motorhome. And sometimes the rearview mirrors on trucks where they're really, really far out, they can clip you. I mean, I know there are some things that you just watch out for because you know that that they're there. But so much of being out there is training or having done it before and having done it so many times. I mean, I think I've been down, I don't know how many times I've been down Thompson Pass, and it's fabulous. Although often in this race, I haven't been the one to do it. And there have been some times when you can't even see the person in front of you because it's so foggy. I mean, we've been in those kind of situations.
That would be a little crazy.
So I'm kind of afraid for the person on the bike. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really, each part of the experience, you take it as it comes and you deal with it. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like that fear factor is, while you're on the bike, you manage everything and you mm-hmm. manage what you're doing. I mean, that's just having done it. That's yeah. what you do.
Do you do other long distance rides that are not part of a competition where you're just doing an inner city ride of some kind?
Oh, you know, training, you do rides. I think I haven't trained as much this year as I have in some other years, but my favorite ride in training is going up the pass to Hope and back. So starting like at Turnagain Arm and then going over the pass and going out to Hope and back, and it's about 70-some miles. But it's a really cool route because a lot of it's on a bike trail, so you get off the highway, and then a lot of it's on the road to Hope, which yeah. is also not, you know, really well traveled. So it's a great way to have an unimpeded ride. Mm-hmm. It's really mm-hmm. fun.
Yeah. So Janice, I've been told that if you're doing endurance events, you need to do the distance that is in the event in your training. So if you're training for a marathon, you need to be doing 20-mile runs for a series of, you know, weeks before the marathon. Or if you're doing a 50K ski, you need to do some 3-hour events. If you've only done a 2-hour training, then the final hour of your 3-hour event is going to feel really bad. You've done all these 24-hour events. Do you actually train for 24-hour periods before that? Or how do you get your body ready for that?
No. It's like riding for 24 hours is so stressful on the body that you would spend so much of your time recovering
right.
and actually losing fitness. So, I mean, with training, the idea is to gradually introduce your body to stress and then allow it to recover, and it'll come back stronger than it was before. So you would gradually or incrementally increase your mileage. And you just pointed out, to run a marathon, you don't need to run 26 miles to race it, but you need to kind of come close.
Yeah.
But with 400 miles, I mean, it's kind of hard to ride 300, 350 miles. Some people can certainly do that quite well and recover for most people, that would be kind of a tall order. You know, I certainly do work with athletes that I would push to that level, but they're pretty experienced and, their bodies can handle it. So some of that is pretty individual, but, you know, I'd say several good rides as you're peaking for an event that lasts about 24 hours is a good idea, maybe even up to 12 hours in duration.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you don't want to have to require, you know, a 3-week recovery to come back from something like that. But, you know, you do want to have quite a bit of volume in your legs.
Yeah. And when you've got a training regime, if you're planning for a certain season, you can do a lot of volume at the early part, right? And then sort of taper off and then come back up again. Is that mm-hmm. something you would do in cycling?
Yeah, you could in theory, you know, peak twice, and oftentimes your second peak is better than the first.
Mm-hmm.
But, I'll have athletes on kind of different programs, some doing a lot of volume initially and then working on speed the closer they get to the event. So the more you work on speed, the lower your volume has to be. There's always this balance between volume and intensity. Other people, because of their jobs or where they live, you might have them doing intensity earlier in the year. Say, you know, it's winter and all they do is ride their trainers. It's kind of hard to sit on your trainer for 6 or 7 hours at a time. So, we'll focus on
That's
intensity.
A nightmare.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll focus on intensity during the winter. And then when the streets thaw out, start building up their volume.
Mm-hmm. So what is your own, are you trying to peak for this particular race? I know you do a lot of racing. Is there a time period when you're trying to peak?
Well, for this one, again, we're just trying to have fun. So I haven't really put a whole lot of effort into training specifically for it.
Mm-hmm.
because I like to race long distance. I don't really train for short distances. I mean, 400 miles seems like a long way, but when you divide it by four, I only have to ride 100 miles, but I have to ride it really fast in smaller increments. So, you know, that's something that I'm not really accustomed to, but we've been trying as a team to do some of the local bike races to kind of help us get ready.
And so it is not the crowning achievement you're going for, but you still want to do good, right?
Yeah, I mean, you still want to put a little effort.
Once you get out there, your competitive juices are going to flow, and all this stuff about having fun is going to be completely out the window.
That's how we have fun is to be competitive. So, looking forward to that.
Yeah, I hear you. We had Nancy Pease on the show to talk about Mount Marathon right before the 4th of July. And she, of course, was a huge competitor in the Mount Marathon race for years. And then she retired, and I ran into her at a 4th of July picnic, and there was a sack race. And, you know, this incredible competitor, even in a sack race, was an incredible competitor.
Nancy's amazing. Yeah, I've known her for a lot of years, and she never does anything halfway.
I think that for the really good athletes, that's part of it, isn't it? That you really, they turn it on because it's part of it's in the blood. They don't quit.
And that's what's fun.
Excellent. Well, I'm having a good time talking about this. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about the Fireweed 400 bike race, which is coming up this weekend, I guess starting Friday and Saturday with the different distances and heats. Got some great guests in the studio. Janice Tower was just talking. She's an elite cyclist. Pam Kravitz is more of a recreational cyclist. And George Stransky, a race organizer, is on the phone. We're going to be back with them for the second half of the show. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Archery 101, this Saturday, July 13th at 10:30 a.m., there will be a free archery instruction for youth and adults at Kincaid Park Annex Bunker and Archery Range. All children must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. Archery 101 continues every Saturday through August 3rd. Potter Marsh Bird Walks, another ongoing event in Anchorage, will continue through July, Saturdays 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. and Tuesdays 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. on the Potter Marsh Boardwalk. Join a guided leisurely walk to identify and learn about the area's wildlife. This family-friendly event is for the beginning birder as well as those that know their way around a bird's wing. Binoculars are available for loan at no charge, and spotting scopes and guidebooks will also be available. And on Tuesday, July 16th, REI Anchorage will offer a free camp cooking basics class at 6 p.m. Learn how to make the most of cooking outdoors. This introductory class will have tips on what to bring and some easy and fun meals to make at camp. You can find out about each of these events on our website. Go to alaskapublic.org, find Outdoor Explorer, and each event has links and dates associated with it. Finally, the Big Wild Ride 1200K is coming up on July 21st. To tell us more about the bike ride stretching from interior Alaska to Prince William Sound, we have Kevin Turinsky of the Alaska Rondineers with us on the phone. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Charles. Thanks for having me.
We're kind of having a big bike day today. What is this event? What is the Big Wild Ride 1200K?
The Big Wild Ride is the Alaska Rondineers signature event at midnight, July 21st. 50 cyclists from around the world, one Alaskan, will be departing Valdez, riding through Fairbanks back into Anchorage in under 90 hours. It's non-competitive, but it's timed, and they've got to do it under 90 hours.
Oh, wow. So how do these cyclists get selected or choose themselves or put into this position, however you want to put it?
Every rider qualifies by riding in the same season what we call a Super Randonneur series, which includes a 200, a 300, 400, and a 600-kilometer event leading up to the Big Wild Ride. Here in Alaska, the Alaska Randonneurs puts on anywhere between 20 and 25 events around Alaska each summer. Our rides are offered all the way, as far south as Homer, as far north as Delta Junction, Togue, the Denali Highway, Talkeetna, Talkeetna, and all stops in between.
I think we mentioned some of them on our show before. So explain to me, it's not competitive, and yet it's timed to make sure you get there in a certain amount of time. Is it? Explain how that works. I mean, you would think that it would naturally be a competitive event, but it's also sounds like it's not really a tour. Explain the non-competitive nature of it.
It's fast-paced cyclotouring where, camaraderie is really the hallmark. And even though they're not non-competitive events, there is a saying in the randonnée world, we know who won. But randonneuring started, soon after the invention of the bicycle, as riders or just, human nature, people wanted to discover just how far they could go on a bicycle during a normal day from dawn to dusk. That turned out to be around 200K, and it would generally take about 13 and a half hours. So it developed from there back in France and Italy. In fact, the Paris-Brest-Paris 200K, which attracts about 6,000 riders every 4 years in France, is the original Tour de France.
Hmm. So when you talk about 1,200K in 90 hours, please tell me that they're not riding 90 continuous hours. They're stopping and resting now and then, right?
For the most part, they are stopping and resting. Some people will try to see how fast they can go on the course. We do attract a lot of riders, specifically on our shorter rides. They might be training for an event like the Fire Week 400, which you were just talking about. But what we've done with the Big Wild Ride is we've set up three overnight controls. The first one in Delta Junction, the second one in Healy, the third one in Talkeetna, offering the riders the option to stop, spend a few hours, resupply with drop bags. Essentially, randonneuring is living off the land. In Alaska, it's a little difficult just because things are so remote. It's not like the quaint French villages that one can ride through every 50K or so.
Yeah. So where are these riders coming from? You said that there's only one Alaskan rider in the event. Where are the others coming from?
We have riders coming in from Germany, New Zealand, all across the U.S., Canada, Japan. And in the past, we've had riders from Sweden, South Korea, Belgium. In the U.K., of course, all over the place.
That's really interesting. I never knew about that this was going on. So it's not really a participatory event, but is there a way for people to sort of see the ending or watch it go by?
Absolutely. I hope if you have any listeners in Valdez that they would be inspired to come out and see the midnight start as riders roll out of town from the Mountain Sky Hotel. Here in Anchorage, we'll be finishing right down at Ship Creek at the Comfort Inn. And so, everyone's encouraged to come down and catch some of the riders rolling in. In fact, if anybody does want to volunteer for the finish, we do have several time slots that need to be filled.
All right. Well, good luck. It sounds like a great event, and thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Okay, Kevin Terinsky, and we have a link to the Big Wild Ride 1200K on our website, as well as all the other events that I mentioned on the Outdoor Explorer calendar. That's at alaskapublic.org. Just look for today's show. You can post your own event at alaskapublic.org just by clicking on Community Calendar. And we always want to hear about your events, your ideas, things you'd like to hear on the show, guests you'd like to suggest, or comments on today's show. We do that through Facebook. Just go to Facebook and look for Outdoor Explorer. So please stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll continue to talk about the Fireweed 400 bike race when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
We're back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about the Fireweed 400 bike race, which is starting this weekend. And 750 riders heading out over the Glen Highway and the Richardson Highway on this great adventure for the race across Alaska. Some of them racing to set time records, and some of them just doing it to have fun. We have three guests with us today. George Stransky is one of the race organizers. He's with us on the phone. We'd promised Peter Leakish, but Peter's out dealing with the crises and getting the race actually organized out there. So George was willing to step in at the last minute, and we appreciate that. Janice Tower is one of the racers, and so is Pam Kravitz, and they're both here in the studio, soon to be off on the road, I guess, to start the race. George, what are the... Peter is telling porta potties where to be set up and doing all kinds of organizational stuff out there on the highway. When does all this process start of getting organized? It must be just a huge, huge effort for you guys to put all this together.
Yes, we have a race committee of about 15 people, and we work all year at doing it. But luckily, we've kept almost the same race committee for the full 11 years that we've run the race. So people know their jobs and work well together, and it's really enjoyable to work with them on the race. And then, I don't know, J&L Properties, Kaladi Brothers Coffee, and ConocoPhillips support us too. So that's truly helpful in getting some of the expenses like porta potties and signs taken care of.
Mm-hmm. And so 11 years, were you involved with it when it started?
I was.
So whose idea was this? How did this come about?
Well, there used to be a regular race between Anchorage and Fairbanks, and then they stopped organizing it. And so Peter Leakish, Bob Voris, and Jim Mendenhall went out and tried to find a different course that had a little safer traffic pattern. And they thought the Sheep Mountain Lodge to Valdez and perhaps back is very picturesque and has low traffic volume, and it would be good for a race. And then the people from Alaska decided that indeed it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's such beautiful country. It seems a little... I don't know if it's sadistic or masochistic to have to ride up Thompson Pass. I mean, that's just got to be a brutally difficult thing to do.
It is 8 miles of a 7% grade, but Pam and Janice are both good at it.
Yeah, they can tell us all about it, yeah. So on a practical level, Sheep Mountain Lodge is a really remote area. There's not much out there at all. There's a couple of little lodges. How does that area absorb this number of people needing lodgings and meals and everything else? Or does everybody kind of bring their own stuff?
No, a quarter mile from Sheep Mountain Lodge, there's a big airstrip. And we put down parking for like 800 vehicles, and people can put their tents up, and then they can cook themselves, or they can walk about 8 minutes to the Sheep Mountain Lodge, where they have a all-you-can-eat pasta buffet on Friday night. And they have an all-you-can-eat breakfast first thing Saturday morning.
Uh-huh. And that's a great outdoor-oriented spot there with Zach Steer and Annette and all that. It's a really friendly spot. And the lodge across the street is great, too, Majestic Valley Lodge.
Yeah, the Majestic. They have beautiful views of the glacier. And as of 4 days ago, they still had two rooms available.
Really? That's amazing. People must assume
they have some cancellations.
Oh, I see. I was thinking maybe everybody assumes they're full. So, Pam, have you done that uphill ride? Have you done that uphill ride on the pass outside of Valdez personally?
Every year we've done the 400.
But, I mean, you personally.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, because they're, you know, when you're on a team, you're doing that ride.
You're part of it. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess I wanted to say something, too, with this division between recreational and competitive athlete. And something about the Fireweed 400 that's really remarkable is the breadth of people that do it. You know, and I know how I got into athletics, and that is, you know, you do a 5K, and then you do a 10K, and then you do a whatever. Well, this race makes it so easy for people to see the people who are doing the shorter, and then the longer, and then aspire to it. And so you see someone like Janice Tower as a one person doing 400, and you think, I can do that. It puts everybody together. And that's the coolest thing about this race. You know, it's not elite, it's community, but the elite people are there. And they're inspirational to everybody else. And I really think, when you talk about athletes, I think everybody considers themselves an athlete. I mean, the way people compete, people like me who are recreational, we go as fast as we can go. I mean, we do try to do our best. It's not like we're, you know, slower going down. You know, we're slower than the elite people, but we really do try our best. And I think everyone out there is like that. And what's so cool is that you recognize people you know, and they're cheering you on, and you're cheering them on. And it's just a really neat race.
I think that's true across a lot of the community events we have in Anchorage, from the ski races to the running races to certainly biking, and that it's an opportunity for people of different ability levels to go out and test yourself. And, you know, certainly I know I'll never be probably even the front half of any of these races, but I am competing against that guy right ahead of me in the red t-shirt.
And do you consider yourself an athlete?
For half an hour, I hate that guy. I gotta beat him,
right?
Yeah. And then at the end, we're, you know, shaking hands and making friends. Yeah. So I know what you're talking about. Yeah. And also, you know, who's buying the stuff that the sporting goods stores are selling that is the high grade stuff? There's not that many elite athletes in the world. You know, it's all of us sort of back of the packers who want to be a little bit better.
Well, and that's the whole point, frankly. I mean, to get people out there and doing things and not making it seem elite and special. Anybody can do this. You know, it really takes just the desire. This isn't something special. Anybody can do it. You know, some people are naturally talented and they're going to do it better than everybody else, but that doesn't mean every single person can't try. And that's the kind of thing that I always think about with athletics. You know, I think about it always because we're such a society that looks for winners. And sometimes winning is not important, you know, most times. In this sort of thing, it's not. And really just getting yourself out there sometimes is the whole competition. Yeah.
I wonder if we kind of send a message through our high school athletics that, in fact, really being the best or getting your letter is really what counts. I think there's some sports, no-cut sports we have here in Anchorage, where everybody's involved, but there's a lot that are really just focused on the best. And so that, I think, propagates a message through the society that, you know, don't join a race if you're not going to be near the top or competitive.
Well, and that's not this race, which is what's really special and wonderful about it.
But don't you think, and Janice, you know, jump in on this too, because I know you work with a lot of athletes. Don't you think that when you reach a certain age, your ego maybe allows you to not try to be the best, and that you can just go out there and compete and do your best, and that's good enough for you? I mean, there's a little bit of a maturity level thing there, and I see the age ranges in a lot of our local races, not only biking but also running, skiing, is kind of offset towards the middle-aged people who sort of maybe have reached that recognition about themselves. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I certainly fall into that category, just trying to do my best and recognizing that, you know, I'm probably not as fast as I used to be, but it doesn't mean that I enjoy it any less. I just like to go out and get a good workout in and participate. And, you know, it's one of the neat things about cycling is that, you know, the bicycle is such a great equalizer. Anybody can ride a bike. Doesn't matter if you're fast or you're slow, you can still participate. You don't need a team to do it. Nobody gets cut. You know, everybody can get out there and ride. And that's the cool thing about the Fireweed is that, you know, riding 50 miles is huge for some people. But it's something that's accomplishable, and you know, later on they might want to try the 100, like Pam said, and maybe look at doing the 200 one of these days. So, you know, again, it's not so much how fast you get there, is that, you know, you set a goal to complete it, and you know, you don't have to ride the full distance because you can be on a team. So there really is something for everybody. And one thing, another aspect of this Fireweed event that's really cool is the two-day, kind of the touring component. So you can ride half the way starting Friday and then stay at a lodge and then get up the next day and ride the rest of the way into Valdez. So for people who, you know, don't want to go the whole distance, but they want to get to Valdez, I mean, that's a really outstanding option.
I'm interested in the equipment aspect. I think most people who have not participated in a bike race, which would include me, would think that if you don't have a really good bike, you'd have a big disadvantage. And so you need to spend a lot of money on a top flight bicycle to be in a bike race. I guess I'm interested in both of you. How much do you need to spend on a competitive level road bike, and how much difference does that make?
You really don't need an expensive bike. It just has to have two wheels. Yeah, a couple of brakes, you know, a few gears. And, you know, actually, some people might do it on a single speed or a fixed gear bike.
Who did it on a single speed the first year?
Pat Irwin.
Yeah, and that's how he ended up with the 200, because he stopped at the 200-mile mark and did get on a ferry, and they decided that's a good distance, too.
So, no, I mean,
but there must be a benefit of having a good bike, or they wouldn't make them.
Well, you know, your bike should work efficiently and, you know, be able to get through all the gears. You know, you definitely want to go out there with good functioning equipment, but you don't necessarily have to have the lightest, fastest, most expensive bike. Any bike will do.
Yeah, Ben Couturier worked at REI, and he was 17 years old, and he got a bicycle frame out of a dumpster and put some wheels on it and won the 400. And then the next year went on to be the youngest person to ever complete solo race across America. So he started out with a 400-mile event in our race with a bike frame that was free.
Huh. Yeah, well, I guess if you got enough talent and physical ability, you could probably overcome anything, huh?
But Charles, I understand where you're coming from, because, I mean, a little bit is, you know, well, I know I'm not going to be really fast, so what can I do to kind of help me along? And you think about that with skiing, and you think about that with your bike and everything else, and, you know, it depends on what you want to accomplish. I mean, that's it. Many years ago, I did an Ironman triathlon, and that was the first time I ever thought about getting a faster bike, because I too have the mountain bike that I've done in every one of these. And, you know, it wasn't a huge fast bike, but I had a deadline. I had to get the bike done in, and I'm not, you know, I'm a recreational athlete, and we're aiming for the deadline. We're not aiming to win. And that was the only time that I ever, and I'm still using that bike, which is fairly old and not, you know, but it's great, and I'm glad I have it.
Now, here's the flip side for recreational competitors in citizen races. If you have really bad equipment, then you've got an excuse, you know? There was a funny article that was written in the Nordic skiing newspaper a couple of years ago about making sure you got your excuses ready at the beginning so that you don't look like you've got the latest, greatest bike or ski or whatever, and then don't do very well. So it's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about the Fireweed 400 bike race, which is coming up this weekend. And in the studio, we have Janice Tower and Pam Kravitz, who are both going to be riding. And George Stransky is on the phone, and he is one of the organizers of the race. Sounds like one of the founders of the race as well. George, I wanted to ask a sort of a harder question here. There have been a lot of scandals in running, you know, the marathon community over the years, of people cutting courses, people jumping in a taxi cab or a car. And it sounds like this is a lot of an honor system kind of race, because if you're covering this amount of distance and you've got people being supported by vehicles, it would be pretty easy for somebody to cheat. Is that sort of the philosophy? Is it's an honor system and you're just sort of assuming everybody's out there for good fun? Or is there some way you sort of check on people to make sure that they're being fair?
Well, you do have six cars, official vehicles out on the course going back and forth. With the 400 riders, it's more difficult because the riders keep track of one another. There's not too many of them, so that another 400 rider would be surprised if someone that was behind them showed up in front of them.
Right, you do. Yeah.
We've not had any problems like that at all. We don't have any prize money per se, and it used to be that you had to finish within 15% on the 400 distance to qualify for Race Across America, but now you do not. Anyone who finishes the 400 is qualified for Race Across America. So there's no particular incentive to try to cheat on this race, and we've never even had a hint of that happening.
Mm-hmm. Janice, the sport of cycling in total has been just so tarnished with the Tour de France doping scandals, and Lance Armstrong is such a disappointment to everyone. How has that affected the sport, in your view? I mean, does it make any difference to people here in Alaska doing their stuff, or is it sort of so far away in terms of professional cycling in Europe that we don't even really think about it?
Yeah, I don't get the sense that it's a factor in terms of whether people would be turned off by cycling. You know, certainly that whole era in watching the multiple time champion, I mean, it definitely energized people and got people into the sport. You know, you could never take that away. I mean, it really did a tremendous, increase in participation. I'll put it that way. And, you know, people who are into cycling are into it for the love of the sport. They just love riding their bikes. And I really don't think that what those guys who are, you know, what they're doing at the top is really going to make a difference about, you know, how it impacts your average cyclist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a tremendous disappointment. And, you know, I don't know what can be done about it other than to bring kids up with good ethics and good values. And, you know, especially kids who have dreams of becoming professional cyclists, you know, you just have to instill that ethic in them is, you know, never cross that line. So, but, you know, no, I mean, I think for the average person, it really isn't going to make a lot of difference.
Something way off in the far distance. Yeah. Well, I think it does affect kids support maybe more than adults in terms of creating heroes out of athletes and then seeing them be, essentially cheaters. I think that that's happened in not only cycling, but in other sports as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, you want that kid to say, you know, I want that dream, but I don't want to be that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
Who gets popped for using,
I know,
using drugs. So, there's a lot of mentoring that needs to go on out there and in the cycling world in general with parents and coaches and what have you. And just, you know, say, hey, you know, there comes a time where it has to come to an end.
Mm-hmm. Pam, any thoughts on that?
I think it comes down to competition and the playing field. If everybody's doing drugs, then that's what, you know, people feel they have to do in order to compete. And, you know, during that time, I don't think there was anybody who wasn't, you know, doing...
It sure sounds like it.
Performance-enhancing drugs, and who knows what it's like right now. I mean, it is really discouraging. And, you know, I think a lot of people were disappointed. But I have no solutions.
Yeah.
I guess I wanted to say another thing. Mm-hmm. I know Janice and I share that our families are active. And I know this race, I can't remember if your son did too, but my son really got into biking with this race too. And it's a really cool family thing. So when you're talking about values and all these kind of, competition sort of things, if you're doing something like this together and you're sharing the experience and you're kind of giving people the opportunity to really shine, that is really important.
Yeah. I know the number of families who've done it, and it seems like be a great thing. There's no electronics involved, you know, you're outdoors and you're doing something together. Yeah.
Yeah, my son and I did the 200 a couple years ago on a tandem. And so we had 10 hours of quality time together.
Oh,
And it was a blast. I mean, he's really funny, and he had me laughing the whole time. So it was really just a wonderful time on a bike with my son.
If it goes well, it would go great. If not, take a hacksaw and cut the two halves apart, right?
Well, my husband and I have been doing the 400 for years together, right? Uh-huh. And, you know, but the really good thing is that you're not in the car at the same time usually, you know, so you don't have that opportunity to, except when you're doing it as a four person, but then you're sleeping when you're mm-hmm. in the car. So, yeah, it's fun.
So, in the category of questions you always wanted to ask, what about your rear end? I mean, if I go biking for most of the day, the next day my behind is sore. And I just think if I rode 400 miles without a break, or even like we're talking about a 1,200 mile event that the runners are doing, man, that would do you get over that eventually, or how does that? I mean, I'd love to hear from both of you. And George, you weigh in as well.
Well, I like to say you have to break your rear end into the saddle rather than break your saddle in. But no, I mean, it's the course. The more you ride, the more toughened up you're going to be, uh-huh. and everyone's anatomy is different. So you want to try to experiment with different saddle shapes and how much padding there is, whether you prefer a firm saddle or one with more cushion. So if you have an opportunity to borrow saddles from friends to just kind of get an idea of, you know, what the general shape is and how much padding to have. But I think the saddle should be comfortable from the very second you sit down. And then you kind of know you're on the right track.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Pam, anything to add?
That sounds like shoes. That's really interesting. No, but I'd ask George's question. Am I wrong, but did you do Race Across America at some point?
Yes, in 2000, they're on a team of relay team of four people. And whenever I travel to a bike race, I always took my pedals and my shoes and my bike saddle with me on my person, so that if my bike didn't make it, I could put my equipment on a bike frame and compete.
Yeah, sounds like a good plan. Something that you definitely want to protect an important part of your anatomy. Well, if at that undignified end, we're going to have to finish the show here. I want to thank my guest, George Stransky, who is on the phone, Janice Tower and Pam Kravitz in the studio. Thanks so much for being with us. It was fun to share about this, and good luck this weekend. Looks like you'll have nice weather for it. Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, so. Thank you.
All Thanks. Right. And Kevin Terinsky was with us earlier talking about the Big Wild Ride 1200K. On next week's show, we'll be talking about dip netting on the Kenai River, which started this week and lasts for 3 weeks. Supposed to be a good year for Reds, and many people from Anchorage will fill their freezers. Tim Wilson from B&J Sporting Goods will be in the studio with me to talk about how to do it and the equipment you need. I'll also have Rick Cook, the city manager of Kenai, where having 15,000 dip net fishermen descend is a big disruptive issue which has health, safety, and community concerns. We'd love to hear from you as well. Do you think there's a way to make dip netting better for everyone, including the folks who live by the river? Find us on Facebook, Outdoor Explorer. We'd also like to hear your ideas and suggestions for future shows and guests. We do take them, and we do build shows around them. Our show today was engineered by Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is the producer of Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.